Welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com, and that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com. It is the 20th of February 2014 and this is episode 177 of the podcast. Right, so there's been a quote from Charles Bukowski, the poet, that's been doing the rounds on social media. Find what you love and let it kill you, which some days I kind of agree with. You know, I want to go all out for what I do. But personally, I actually do want a long-term career and I want to have a good time along the way, as long as writing lots of books. So today's interview, I'm talking to Todd Henry, author of Die Empty, great title, about how we can manage the production of work and give of our best every day, but also, you know, how to care about our creative soul as such. And sort of manage that that rhythm. So before we get into the interview, a little update. The news in the publishing industry since the last show has really been around authorearnings.com, which has been set up by Hugh Howey, indie idol, let's say, Hugh Howey, and a data guy, an anonymous data guy. And what they've done is they have a spider which is crawling the Amazon site, and they're about to release Barnes & Noble as well, and sort of coming up with the data and doing some analysis over the data. And they started off with 7,500 sort of best-selling books. They've gone to 50,000. They've looked at print, whether print is a issue, which it basically isn't, and we shouldn't get so het up about it. Some of the big conclusions that may or may not be a surprise, you know, the data does show that for genre fiction, certainly, romance, sci-fi, fantasy, mystery, thriller, genre fiction returns more income for indie authors than it does for traditionally published authors. And the balance, and this is obviously at Amazon, so, you know, really very skewed. And also that in the top, I think top 1,000, something like 80%+ of the bestsellers are in Kindle. So, you know, worrying about print in terms of best-selling books is not that big a deal. Anyway, there's loads of interesting stuff there, so check it out, authorearnings.com. And you could also, if you Google author earnings plus Hugh Howey or something like that, you will find a whole load of rebuttals and people having a go at the data. But this is just the start. I think it started on the 12th of February, so it's only been going like a week and a half. And it's going to be a long-term project and they're going to look at data from all kinds of places. And I think essentially the aim is to empower authors to make better decisions. The balance on indie income was obviously a lot less for literary fiction, non-fiction, children's books and other genres. So it's definitely worth going and checking out that site, having a look at that. Updates from my own writing. I'm now in the final scenes of Delirium, which I'm happy with. I had got a bit lost and, you know, was struggling with my timeline, but now I'm back on track. The draft will be finished by the end of February, and then I'm going to rest the manuscript before I do the rewrite. And I am going to get on with this Viking mystery short story, blow things up thing, novella it will probably be. I'm really desperate to blow things up in my writing. It's quite funny. And then also I need to get into Inquisition, which will be another full-length arcane book, and hopefully I'll be off to Spain to do some research on that, dependent on a few things. Other book news from me, I've now managed to get all my fiction and how to market a book onto the iBookstore, so you can, Pentecost is free as well, so if you want to check out my books there, they are on iBookstore. I pulled off Smashwords, Book Baby, Draft to Digital and have gone direct. It has been difficult, but I'm very happy that I'm now direct on the big retailers, and I'll be looking at Google Play next, I suppose, although there's lots of problems there, but I'll definitely be blogging about iBookstore and Google Play if I get there. Public Speaking for Authors, Creatives and Other Introverts is also now available in print on Amazon, as well as ebook on Kobo and Amazon, so, and coming soon on iBookstore. So yeah, world domination continues. I am also trying out some new cover designs. So if you go and check out Pentecost and Desecration now, I guess, whenever that is, I've redesigned them to have, well, I haven't, thanks to Derek Murphy at Creative Indie, who's fantastic. We've put a Morgan Sierra character on the front of Pentecost, and Desecration has been completely changed from an arty style cover around theme to a sort of crime genre cover, much darker, with a character on the front as well. So I'm going to be blogging about this change once I've got some results on the data. But I decided to make this change after reading blog posts from Russell Blake and H.M. Ward, who between them have sold gazillions of books, about changing covers, how changing covers really help them sell more. And both of them went with images of people and genre targeted covers. So I'm really interested to see how, you know, if this makes a difference. But one of the brilliant things about being indie is the ability to change out covers very easily. So we'll see how it goes. Also, I'm in a box set, which I mentioned in the last podcast, but Deadly Dozen by The Twelve is out now on Amazon, iBookstore, Nook and Kobo, and I'll be having a competition on the blog on the 24th of February, so you can buy it anytime, but if you buy before the 25th of February, you can join in the competition. And it is 12 books for 99 cents, and the collective value is about $45. So it's very good value, and 12 best-selling and award-winning authors, and I'm thrilled to be part of that. And you can read more about the book or the authors at the12xii.com/deadlydozen. Or we are The 12 on Facebook, so quite excited about how that's going to go, and I'll tell you about that another time. I'll tell you about the results, I mean, another time. Okay, so the podcast is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and in fact, our next interview will be Mark Lefebvre from Kobo, and I will be drilling down on how to sell more on Kobo tips next show. But meanwhile, here's a message from our sponsor.
Hi, Creative Pen listeners. This is Mark Lefebvre, Director of Self-Publishing and Author Relations for Kobo, and I'm here to provide you with a little bit of a tip for indie authors. You've often heard people say that the cover is very, very important. I know here at Kobo, our merchandisers will look at covers, and they look at thousands of covers in a single day, and they will make a judgment in a split second on whether or not that is a good cover. One of the factors associated with good cover is considering your target audience. A good cover for a fantasy novel is not the same as a good cover for a thriller audience. A good cover for a non-fiction how-to-do-it book is not the same as a good cover for a romance novel. So part of having a good cover isn't just having a beautiful design with a readable font on it that's visible in a thumbnail. It's also making sure that that cover appeals to your target audience. We provide tips like this via the blog at KoboWritingLife.com, and do check us out and publish your works to Kobo's global catalog. Now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Todd Henry. Welcome, Todd.
Thanks, Joanna. It's great to be here.
super to have you on the show. So just as an introduction, Todd is the best-selling author of Die Empty, Unleash Your Best Work Every Day, one of Amazon's best books of 2013, and also Accidental Creative. He's also the founder of AccidentalCreative.com, a business that helps creative people generate ideas. So Todd, you're everywhere on the internet and it's all amazing, but tell us a bit more about you and your background in writing and business.
Sure, absolutely. So I studied marketing in school. And after marketing, I did kind of a tour of duty in the music business for a while. I think it's sort of rite of passage for marketing majors that you have to spend some time in the music business at some point. And then through a long series of events, ended up leading a creative team, a group of creatives, designers, writers, and was trying to figure out how to help them be more effective in what they do every day. And we were working very long hours. We were working, 60-hour weeks and longer. And I started asking some of my creative director friends at agencies around town, hey, how do you keep your teams engaged? How do you keep them fresh? How do you keep them charged up and excited about the work? And they looked at me like I had two heads. I mean, they're saying, well, what do you mean? We don't worry about that. We just, burn through people and bring in a fresh crop of creatives. And I thought, well, that doesn't seem right. That doesn't seem like the way to really invest in people as a leader. It doesn't seem like how you could help them, do their best work. So I started doing some research about how effective creative professionals, people who produce tremendous value over the long term, seem to be able to do that. Are there some commonalities there? And then as a leader, what are some things I can do to begin helping my team do that as well, and began implementing some of these practices. And then, because I was having difficulty finding any kind of conversation about this, any kind of resources to help me do that, I created a podcast in 2005 called The Accidental Creative. And the idea was to start a conversation about creating in the marketplace. So what does it look like for people who have to go to work and write every day? They have to design, they have to lead teams or build products. How can they be more effective? Started this podcast, kind of forgot about it, frankly. I mean, it was just, I wanted to kind of vent and get some ideas out there. Came back about a month later looking for podcasts to listen to, some business podcasts. And I discovered this podcast called The Accidental Creative that was one of the top business podcasts on iTunes. And my first thought was, oh no, I stole someone else's name. I can't believe I didn't check first, right? But it was my podcast and there were apparently thousands of people listening to it. And so that pretty quickly, I'll sort of short circuit the story a little bit, that pretty quickly turned into me being invited to come and spend time with teams, helping them generate ideas, which then really became my business, several years ago, and then spent several years doing that. The books came along shortly thereafter. And that's pretty much what I'm doing now, is helping creatives and teams generate ideas more effectively and be more productive in what they do on a day-to-day basis. So that's kind of the short version of it.
Which is fantastic. And I mean, most of my listeners write books, fiction and some nonfiction. But, yes. In general, we're kind of book authors and I guess less business people, although I'm trying to educate people on the whole entrepreneurship side of things. But let's get straight into Die Empty as the book. Just give us a sort of high level pitch about the book, because the phrase could probably be quite scary for some people.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of a hurdle. I think for some people, and that was an intentional choice. When I talked with the publisher about the book, we were really trying to decide, are we going to call it Die Empty? That was kind of the going title, and we were trying to figure out, is this what we're going to do or not? And, we really felt like it was provocative. It was something that would really cause people to think. But it also, obviously, there's some negative psychology going on there, especially with, the big box retailers, book retailers and whatnot. Are they going to really buy into a book called Die Empty? But the general idea of the book is this. Listen, we all have a finite amount of time on earth, and we all have a finite amount of resources to spend in the pursuit of whatever it is we want to do. So if we're writing books, we have a finite amount of time to get those books out of us, get them into the world and provide value to those around us. And several years ago, a friend of mine was leading a meeting and he asked this kind of out of the blue question in the meeting. He said, what do you think is the most valuable land in the world? We're all thinking, that's a weird question. I don't know, and he said, well, I think the most valuable land in the world is the graveyard. I think it's the cemetery, because in the graveyard are buried all of the unwritten novels, all of the unlaunched businesses, all of the unexecuted ideas, all of the things that people carried around with them their entire life. And they thought, well, I'll get around to that tomorrow. I'll start that tomorrow. And they pushed it into the future until one day they reached the end of their life and all of that value was buried with them, dead in the ground, never to be seen by human eyes. And that day I wrote down two words. I put them on the wall of my office. I put them in my notebook. And those two words were "die empty," because I want to know at the end of my life, when I reach that bookend of my life, I'm not taking my best work to the grave with me. I've done everything I can on a daily basis to empty myself of whatever's in me, to provide value to people around me. If it's something I need to write, something I need to say to someone, a loop I need to close, I want to make sure I'm doing whatever I can on a daily basis to get that out of me, so that when I reach the end of my life, I can die empty of regret about where I put my focus, my assets, my time, and my energy, that I've spent myself in the pursuit of something worthy. I've built a body of work that I can be proud of. So that's really what die empty means. It's not, collapse exhausted across the finish line. It's no, you want to be able to die empty of regret about where you put your most valuable resources. And unfortunately for a lot of people, Joanna, they're not as intentional as they should be about how they spend those finite resources. And they look back on their life and they realize they made decisions out of fear. They made decisions out of comfort. They made decisions that weren't really in the pursuit of something they knew was the right thing. Instead, they chose a different path. And they end up regretting that deeply. And so what I wanted to do is articulate some of the ways that we can be intentional about spending our resources in the pursuit of what matters most to us.
And I completely agree. But it's interesting right now, there's a bit of a meme going around. I don't know if you've seen it, saying the Charles Bukowski quote, "Find what you love and let it kill you."
Yes,
which is kind of, the quote's going around. And it made me think of your book. But I wonder, what do you think the balance is between that giving of your all kind of every day and also needing to recharge and refresh our kind of creative wells?
Yeah, there's definitely a rhythm there. And that was really the first book, The Accidental Creative, was really about the idea that we need to have rhythm in our life. We can't be going 24/7. We have to have rhythms, like you said, of filling the well, of recharging ourselves, sharpening our mind, developing our skills, sometimes just kicking up our legs and watching television for a while. You know, whatever it is that we need to do to recharge ourselves, to position ourselves to be effective when we need to be, we have to take all of that into account. So I think there's unquestionably a balance there, but I prefer the word rhythm over balance, because I think if we strive for balance, I think that tends to mean, we want a little bit of everything, a little bit of this, a little bit. But I think when we talk about rhythm, that means sometimes there are going to be seasons, like right now I'm writing a new book. There are seasons in my life where I am intensely focused, and this is really everything else in my life is subservient to this thing I'm doing because it is the main thing right now. And then there are seasons in my life where that is subservient to whatever else is more important during that season. And I think as artists, as writers, as those who are producing value on a daily basis, we have to strike a rhythm with our life that allows us to bring ourselves fully to the work that we do, but also recognize we work best out of that time that we spend filling ourselves, sharpening ourselves. And so it's easy to neglect, like you said, it's easy to neglect those elements of filling our well and recharging ourselves when we're deeply passionate about the work that we're doing, when we find something that is worth spending our life on. But that's exactly when we need to be disciplined enough to say, okay, well, yes, I could work on this until 11 o'clock this evening and get up at 4 in the morning and start working again. But I also recognize I care enough about the work that I'm going to take the time to step back, recharge my well, reframe my perspective, and then reengage again once I'm charged up. And I think that's an element of learning to be a mature creative, is knowing when to step back and to say, I could kill myself doing this, but I'm not going to do my best work that way. Instead, I'm going to recognize this is really more of a marathon than a sprint.
No, that's a really good point. And it's interesting right now, especially in the fiction world, there's a lot of emphasis on a lot of production. So one of the stories is 22 books written in 30 months by a guy called Russell Blake. I haven't heard of that. And that is really putting a lot of pressure on fiction authors who are going, well, how can I be successful unless I write that much? And it's interesting you say about being a mature creative. I think that's a really good phrase. But I did actually want to ask you something more specific around, you talk about work being split into mapping, making, and meshing, which I liked. And I mean, creatives are normally quite good at making, but not necessarily the other bits. So I wondered if you could talk a bit about those other two.
Yeah, this is really a kindred. I guess this topic is very close to what we were just discussing before, the idea of filling your well, because they're really, we tend to think of work as this giant mesh, this giant melting pot of tasks and plans and activities and strategies. But really, we can kind of parse it out into three separate forms. The first form is mapping, and this is really it's planning. It's, you know, if you're writing fiction, you probably have some sort of story outline. You kind of have the sense of what it is you're going to do. You know about how many words a day you need to write if you want to stay on track with what you're writing. If you're going to write 22 books in 30 months or whatever it is, you have to have some sort of plan there, right, to be able to do that. And so, you know, mapping is important. It's strategizing. It's the work before the work. And then there's making. And this is what we, you know, we typically is being referred to now, thanks to, you know, Seth Godin, as shipping, right? This is actually doing the stuff that you plan. It's executing the tasks. It's actually, you know, making the clickety clack on the keyboard and, you know, cranking out words. And it's the most measurable form of work that we do, you know, so I can look at something at the end of the day and say, I did that. Great. And so we tend to think of work as those two things, mapping and making. So I plan and I do, I plan and I do. And, you know, if you just do that, you're going to make progress, but over time you're going to see diminishing returns on your efforts because you're ignoring the third kind of work. And the third kind of work is what I call meshing. Meshing is the work that's between the work. It's all of the things that hold your mapping and your making together. It's things like developing your skill set, getting a sense of why it is you do what you do, defining your battles, understanding the space that you uniquely play in, finding your voice, you know, discovering the unique expression that you have creatively. All of these things are a part of this meshing element of work. And the problem is it meshing often seems very inefficient. You know, if you tell someone, okay, well, you need to take a couple of hours and go develop your skills. You need to go read another writer that you admire and kind of get inside her head and understand how she thinks about language, right? Something of that nature. It seems very inefficient in the moment because I have a word count to hit today, or I have, you know, other things that I need to do. This doesn't fit my strategic plans. But over the long term, it's the meshing that allows us to continue to grow and continue to be increasingly effective against our objectives. So we have to have all three of those. If you just map and make, I call that person the driver. The driver is the person who, and I work with a lot of organizations. I encounter a lot of drivers in organizations, people who say, give me a task, give me an objective, I will knock it out of the park. I will run through you in order to accomplish this objective, right? They're very nose down. They're driven. They're, you know, it's the kind of person who says, I'm going to crank out a book a week for the next, you know, but they're not really stepping back to ask the question, why am I doing this? Now, what are my real objectives here? And what am I really trying to accomplish? Am I just doing it because somebody told me, hey, I wrote 40, so you have to write 41, right? Like, what is the reason I'm doing this? And that's really what meshing is. And we have to be careful to make sure we don't neglect that in our pursuit of doing the work. And that's the cult of shipping is something I'm concerned about. I think that creatives tend to err on the side of, I think, on the side of ideas and getting excited. And, you know, Scott Belsky talks about the project plateau and this thing of, you know, you jump from shiny object to shiny object because, oh, I've got the ping of a new idea. And I think traditionally that has kind of been the way the pendulum has swung for creatives. We're very distractible. We easily bounce from idea to idea and we leave a wake of half-finished projects, you know, behind us. I think that's traditionally been the case. I'm concerned that we're moving to the other side of the spectrum now where we have kind of the cult of shipping where it's like, we'll just put out something really terrible and then you can always redirect it later, or it's about quantity over quality. Yeah. And I think the truth is in the middle, like with anything. I think the truth is in the gray zone. It's in the middle in between that. And I think that's a very uncertain place to be, but that's what we have to parse, I think, if we really want to do meaningful work. We have to parse the balance between quantity and quality and recognize that that answer is not going to be the same for everybody.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the point. It's not the same for everybody. And it's funny, you talk about that. I've actually got on my wall, I've got a load of stuff on my wall, as you probably do too. But it says, right to live, and what is living today? So I think that living kind of fits into your meshing, because I'm very much a doer, and I need that to remind me, like, is living today just, you know, going out with my husband or, like, you know, cooking some food or traveling? You know, that's a big thing for me. But no, you're absolutely right. And that's really good for people to think about. But I'm also interested in your kind of the longer term stuff around the body of work, which you talk about. And Pam Slim's got a new book out as well called Body of Work. Because certainly, again, fiction authors, you know, at the moment, we get obsessed with our sales figures. We're getting obsessed. Well, you have books too. You know how this feels. Like, what's our ranking today? You know, how many dollars did we make today? And, you know, how do we take a long view of this body of work when we've got bills to pay this month?
That is a tremendous question. I think that's the real challenge for anyone who's producing work on a regular basis, or really you're going to be judged by the work that you produce. I mean, the body of work is the most physical manifestation of what you care about. It's the most physical manifestation of where you chose to spend yourself, those finite resources we talked about earlier. You know, I tell people your fate determines your fate. You know, it's not to be too cutesy, but your fate determines your fate. Your focus, your assets, your time, and your energy. Those are really the four levers that you can pull in the pursuit of building a body of work. So focus, how you define the problems you're trying to solve. So I think for fiction writers specifically, I think you have to ask the question, you know, really what do I feel is being called out of me? What is it that I am uniquely trying to do here? What problem am I trying to solve? And for some, it might be just at the beginning, I need to form a basis of income so I can start asking some of those deeper questions about where do I want to play? What kind of, you know, work do I want to do? Am I just trying to make a living as a writer, or am I trying to contribute something meaningful and valuable to the collective body of work that is, you know, culture? And, you know, I think that that's a question that we all have to ask, you know, at some point. Am I writing in order to just make a living? Is that what I'm trying to do? Or is there something more than I'm trying to do? And again, that's a question everybody has to answer for themselves, you know, but, you know, your focus, how you define that problem. And I think that's important. And for me, you know, really writing is a way of, and I will be really thoroughly frank, having written two books now, and I'm working on my third book, writing is not a pleasurable activity for me. I don't enjoy writing, you know. I mean, it's kind of funny because I'm now on my third traditionally published book. I'm working on my third book, but what I've discovered is that writing is the best way to communicate, to articulate, to get my ideas out there in the world. It's, my friend Ricardo calls it portable equity, right? It's a way to take those ideas and out of the abstract and put them in some tangible form, get people to interact with them. And so, you know, for me, that's, you know, how I define the problem I'm trying to solve, trying to free up creatives to be more of who they are. Well, the best way for me to solve that problem is to get something in their hands that they can interact with. Okay. So, your assets, your physical resources, those are your relational resources, your financial, you know, those are finite, and how you spend them, you know, contributes to that body of work. Your time, 168 hours a week. So we can choose, okay, if I'm going to, say I'm going to write so that I can make a living, which is fine. That's great. Am I also going to dedicate an amount of time to writing things that just charge me up, that are more exploratory, that may never be seen by the world, but they're allowing me to shape my voice and find a new way of expressing myself. So that way my writing doesn't become all about making a living. My writing can also be something I do on the side as a way to kind of shape and refine and experiment. And then that may find form in my, you know, writing that I share with the world at some point or not. But then finally, my energy. You know, how am I positioning myself to bring more of who I am to what I do, which often means being very selective about the projects I choose to take on. And so each of those four elements are what build our body of work. Ultimately, those are the four levers that we have to pull. And that body of work is any place we add value in our lives. So it's not just our job, you know, in this case, writing. For me, it's working with companies or working with individuals or speaking at conferences or whatever it is. That's one, certainly one form, element of my body of work, but it's also, you know, how I lead my family, how I treat my family, how I treat my wife, you know, how I treat the barista at Starbucks, where I choose to spend my money. All of those things are a part of that body of work, or that delta, that change that exists because I sucked air on this earth. And so, again, the answer is different for everyone, but I think there is tremendous value, Joanna, in simply stopping on a daily basis and asking, as you look at what's on your calendar today, or you look at your task list, or you look at the things you're trying to do, ask yourself, why am I doing this? First of all, what is the deeper objective I'm trying to achieve with this? So don't just get carried along by your work, but ask, why am I writing this project? you know? And if you can be honest with yourself and say, I'm writing this project because I know this project is going to sell, and that's going to provide me then with greater assets to be able to spend in the pursuit of building a different body of work, right? But it's okay to be honest with yourself about that and say that. But I think it's important to understand the why behind the what. And that is, I believe, the first step toward building a body of work you can ultimately be proud of. It's just being intentional, recognizing the reason why you're doing what you're doing and making sure that that is aligned with where you want to be long term. So I don't know if that gets to the answer or not, but I mean, for me, that's, you know, the most important thing that I work on with creatives is just helping them understand how not to be carried along by their work, but instead to define their work on a daily basis and make sure that that work reflects what they care about. And if it doesn't reflect what they care about, at least make sure that it is in some way contributes one brick in the wall of their body of work that's helping them get to where they ultimately want to be.
No, fantastic. And I was reminded there because you said you find the writing really difficult.
Yes.
And a great quote by Dorothy L. Sayers that is, you know, writing is something like, you know, it's not about the writing, it's having written that we're proud of. You know, I hate the first draft as well. I love editing. I don't know about you.
I will say editing is a much easier process because very often, and this happened with the new book, with Die Empty, to be completely frank, when I finished the first draft, I turned it in to my editor at Portfolio, Penguin, and I said, yeah, what do you think, right? I don't know, because you're so close to the work. And one thing I've discovered is that we are profoundly terrible judges of the quality of our own work, you know, because we're so close to the work and we need objective voices in our life. Like, I need an objective voice to tell me, hey, you need to stop feeling bad about this because this is actually really good and I think we can make it better. And then it's funny, when I went back to do the audiobook version, to record the audiobook for Die Empty, as I was reading it, it almost felt like someone else's book because I hadn't read it in a few months or 3 months, you know. And as I was reading, there were unfamiliar sentences and things I'd forgotten that I'd written. And I had this thought of, oh, this is actually pretty good, right? Because I was distanced from it and I realized, wow, this is a book I would want to read, which I think for any author, I think is the ultimate compliment you can pay yourself, is when you're reading your stuff and you're thinking, wow, I actually would like to read this. So when you find yourself getting lost in your book, and I don't know if this has happened with you, but you find yourself reading along and you can't stop, and all of a sudden you've been reading for 20 minutes and you're thinking, why am I spending my time reading my own book? I wrote it, for crying out loud, right? But I think that when that happens, it's kind of the ultimate compliment that you can pay yourself.
No, absolutely. Well, I wanted to also ask you about your creative entrepreneur kind of business, because this is one thing we talk about as authors as well. It's, you know, it's not just about writing one manuscript and that's kind of one product. So how have you turned Die Empty into multiple streams of income, I guess?
Right. Yeah. So I'm a little bit unique in that I think for nonfiction writers, it's the biggest market for what I do is with companies and, you know, associations, organizations. So I spend a lot of my time out with companies, with teams, or with you speaking at conferences for, you know, 1,000 people or whatever, who want me to come in and share kind of the top level principles from the book Die Empty with their crowd, to inspire them, to challenge them to think differently about their work. So that really has been the primary market for me. So the book, in many ways, the book is kind of a way of me introducing ideas into the marketplace and then letting those ideas find their way into the right hands. And then hopefully those people who are the right hands then invite me to come and spend time with their company. And so it's been a little bit unique in that sense. But what I've tried to do is, and it's funny, I was just talking with another nonfiction writer yesterday who was asking me advice, because I'm speaking, I'll probably do 50 to 70 speaking events this year. He was asking me, how can I do more of that? And I said, listen, you have to make yourself, you have to package the idea in a way that it is easily accessible from a lot of different angles. So you could have a core idea at the heart of your work. But if you just come in and say, this is what I do, this is what I talk about, you're not likely to find as broad of a market for what you do. But if you can, and this works for a fiction writer, I believe, as well, if you can find different elements or different entry points into that topic that slightly reframe the topic, but makes it a little bit more palatable to different kinds of markets for what you do, then I think you'll be a lot more successful at, again, diversifying your income and finding different kinds of audiences for your work. So, as a fiction writer, don't think that you have to just go in and do, you know, maybe do book readings or, you know, talk about your book, but is there a way you could talk about your process? Is there anything that you learned about yourself through the course of writing a book that you could then maybe use as a way to, you know, communicate with others? And I'm seeing the emergence of a lot of people who want to talk about the process of writing, right? Which is great. I mean, and you do this brilliantly. But you're kind of one of the leading voices in that, which is great. And I think is a very necessary thing for writers. But my concern is that I think people now think that's the only way I can package what I do as a fiction writer outside of the work itself. And I would love to see people start to ask questions about how could I think of myself not just as a writer, but think of myself as someone who uses writing as a way to get my ideas out into the world. But there are a lot of other ways that I can do that, whether that's through speaking or whether it's through working one-on-one with people, helping teams figure out how to utilize story and what they do. You know, I think that there are a lot of different ways that you can, you know, package your work to make that work. So
No, fantastic. And yeah, we do talk a lot about consulting and speaking being other forms of income. When you have a book, it's a kind of logical next step. But I wanted to ask you as well about, because you come from a marketing background and most of us authors haven't, and we've kind of learned this stuff as we go along, but how has the podcast, I mean, because I think there's a bit of a renaissance in podcasting and I love Absolutely. My show, you know, but what do you think at the moment, like if you were starting from scratch, say with a nonfiction book or a fiction book, you know, is podcasting a great marketing tool? You know, what would be your tips around podcasting in particular?
I believe podcasting is a fantastic tool. It's funny because when I started my first podcast back in 2005, my thought was, oh no, I'm so late to the game on this podcasting thing. You know, I'm so past the curve. Am I already too late? Which is hilarious to look at now. It's almost a decade later. And now we're really starting to hit the stride, right? The technology hadn't caught up yet, I think, with common technology hadn't caught up with like the tech crowd on this podcasting thing. And I think now we're seeing it's a lot easier to subscribe and audio's experiencing kind of a resurgence. But I think podcasting, personally, I feel like is maybe the best medium for getting yourself and your personality and your message out there, because it allows people to form a personal connection with you. It allows people to not feel like they're just interacting with your work, but to actually get to know you and to get to know the person behind the work itself. And sometimes it's easy. I mean, it's easy to hide behind your writing, right? To hide behind clever turns of phrases, but there's something just genuine and authentic about audio, about video, that takes some of that away. And so, you know, the listeners to the Accidental Creative Podcast are a fiercely loyal group of people. And it's, you know, we don't have an audience like, you know, This American Life or, you know, Radio Lab, where we have hundreds of thousands of people listening, but we have tens of thousands of people listening. And those tens of thousands of people are very fiercely loyal. And so when I have a book that comes out, I mean, they respond. Or when I, you know, when I tell them, hey, I really love this person, you should go check out their work, they respond to that and they go and they check it out because they feel like they have a connection with me. And in some ways, I'm just revealing myself. Here's what I'm seeing and noticing. So I would encourage any author to establish that kind of a platform where you're not just writing at people and sending out stuff and hoping they interact with it, but you're actually giving them more of a part of yourself by interacting through audio, through video. I've never really done a lot of video, mostly audio. And for a lot of reasons, I think just because I'm more comfortable with that than I am with video. So you can choose your medium. And I think, you know, I think it's a tremendous way. I think any author should be doing that because it allows the audience to feel that personal connection.
And I think reading your own audiobook like you've done, which again, it's probably easier for nonfiction because you don't have to do accents and different voices and stuff. But right. I think it is a very good way for the listener to get the sense of your book.
Right. Absolutely. And it's funny, there's been kind of a polarized response to that. People who are used to the podcast and go out and they buy the book, the audiobook, because they're used to the podcast. They love it because I'm reading it. And people who maybe aren't as familiar with the podcast, they say, well, why is he reading his own book? And this is kind of weird. And they're used to the more professional, you know, audio, you know, person. Yeah. So I think it's kind of a mixed bag and it just depends. But I feel like you know, authenticity is such a critical part of your voice. You know, the being and contextual authenticity, not just, oh, I'm going to be real all the time, I'm going to say whatever I think, but putting that authenticity in context is important. And so for me, reading the audiobook itself was important to me because that's a part of the connection I want to have. It's an authentic expression of the kind of connection I want to have with the audience. So.
Absolutely. Now, and I just wanted to ask you as well about the music business, because, I mean, and you're in traditional publishing right now, but you also right. do a lot online, and you know a lot of the people who are going into self-publishing, you know, professional self-publishing these days. Do you see any parallels with the change in the music business and the publishing business? And, you know, what do you feel is going on right now?
I do. Okay, so I have some pretty strong opinions about this. And being you know, now, I mean, we just signed a third book deal. I'm working on the third book. Being a traditionally published author, I will say, you know, my experience may be a little different in some ways than and so. Let me think of how to say this. I am concerned in that I think that we are at a sort of at the peak of a, think of like a roof, right? We're standing right on the peak of a house. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's an egg balanced on the top, and it could go this way or it could go this way. And the reason for my concern is you look at what happened to the music business. You know, when Apple, who created the devices and had the distribution power to be able to dictate terms to the music industry, said, well, a single is 99 cents. I mean, that's what it is. That's the pricing. Regardless of what it costs you to produce, the market will only bear a 99 cent single if that's what you want to sell. And an album is $9.99. And the people who are selling the devices, who really, frankly, didn't have any skin in the game as it relates to the content and the quality of the content, really, they just wanted to sell devices. They wanted to sell iPods or, you know, iPhones, eventually iPhones. My concern is that we're seeing a similar thing with Amazon, in that while Amazon is opening up the market to anyone, hey, anyone can participate. And I think that's a beautiful, wonderful, necessary thing. And that's only going to result in good in the long run. My concern is that the content producers are not being taken into account when pricing is concerned. And so setting the expectation that, hey, an ebook is, you know, $9 or $10, and that's what it is, or maybe even cheaper. Regardless of how many people or how many were involved or how many years it took to produce that content, right? I just, you know, they don't care about the content. They're just trying to sell Kindles, or they're just trying to get you into the ecosystem, right? So that's my only concern, is that I feel like in some ways you have people dictating the terms of engagement who really have no skin in the game as it relates to the content production. And so I think for authors, especially if you're thinking about sort of, and there's no question that traditional publishing needs to change in response to that, but there's kind of only so much you can do in traditional publishing to change the architecture and the infrastructure to make it, you know, align better with those expectations. I mean, I had people who, when the audiobook for The Accidental Creative was, I think it was priced at $11.99. I want to say the Kindle ebook. And the hardcover at the time was on discount from Amazon. It was like $15.98. So it was right after it came out. So there's some discounting going on. And I had several people email me irate that we were basically pillaging them by charging $11.99 for the ebook and saying, hey, why is it only $3 cheaper than the hardcover? It costs nothing to produce an ebook, right? Why? There's no distribution costs. There's no. And I tried very lovingly to respond to them and say, listen, I mean, the cost to produce a hardcover book and distribute it is just a small fraction of the actual cost of producing the book. The biggest part of it is, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4 years it takes the author to write the book, all of the editors involved, the designers involved. I mean, all that whole process of trying to get the book to market is really the biggest part of the cost. And so, again, you know, I don't want to live in a world where it's okay to just, well, we're just going to scrimp on editorial, we're going to scrimp on design, we're just going to crank something out and put it out there because that's really all the market will bear. I don't think that the market will bear that for very long because it's going to affect the quality. At the same time, I am super, super excited about the opportunities being opened up to authors to say, hey, I don't have to go through some gatekeeper in order to get my work out in the world. The problem at that point is discovery. And I think that's the thing Amazon hasn't really completely cracked the nut on yet, specifically Amazon, is how do authors get their work discovered if they're not you know, traditionally published sitting in a bookstore somewhere on a, you know, or whatever. Like how do we get discovered in that way when there are hundreds of thousands of books coming out every year sitting right beside each other on Amazon? I think that's the, so the promise of this new world is, hey, anybody can do it, you know, and that's great. That's a wonderful thing. But the downside of that is because anybody can do it, everybody is doing it. And so how then do you compete and get discovered in that world? So I think it's an exciting time, but I'm just waiting to see which way the egg falls. Or, I don't know if any of that makes sense. But
yeah, no, it does. I think the egg will kind of split and go both ways. I think there's room for everything in this market. I really do. But anyway, I'm very respectful of your time. I wonder, can you share anything about the new book? Or when can people expect that, or is that
secret? This is again sort of with the traditional publishing process. It comes out in summer of 2015, so it's going to be a little while. I'm actually still writing it now, but yeah, it's going to be primarily about the process of uncovering your voice. So what does it look like? How do you find your voice? How do you discover that sort of resonant thing that causes the inflection point in whether your life or your career, your business, your writing? What does that look like? So that's what I'm working on now, and it'll be again about a year and a half before it comes out. But
well, we'll wait with bated breath for that one, because that's important to everybody. So where can people find you and your books and the podcast online?
Yeah, the best way to find me is just to go to toddhenry.com, toddhenry.com, and then from there you can get to everything else.
Thanks so much for your time, Todd. That was great.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.